That was guaranteed at least one laugh. Mine, I bet you didn't expect to encounter South Park at church tonight, did you? When I heard I was given a talk on authority, the first thing that came to mind, I don't know why, was just Cartman and respect my authority. And I didn't watch much South Park, but there you go. We're talking about, it doesn't really have anything to do with anything, except that we're talking about authority, because as we've been speaking to the community, the second biggest response given to that question, how would you fix the world, is, well, you'd fix authorities, and that'll fix the world. Now, I don't have the hard data on this, but I suspect that of those people who gave this answer, the majority of them are young people. And I suspect that the majority of the people who gave the answer we'll look at in week four, forget it, the world's stuffed, you can't fix it, are probably older people. And so the question to work out is, are we young and naive? I'll throw myself in the young boat there. Or are those crew old and cynical? They're the things that we'll wrestle with. Now tonight, we got a whole bunch of responses that I looked through to do with this issue, and I've put them in one of two categories that I'll take you through. So some responses that have to do with fixing the authorities that we have, and a second category of responses, which is just get rid of authority. Okay, so I want to take you through those two things. I want to dip into some of the responses that have been given and then hold them up to the Bible's teaching on authority. Now, the Bible has a lot to say about authority, and let me just give you right up front a headline statement from Jesus. You ready? It's massive. He said, "All authority in heaven and on earth, it's mine." Massive claims from a man who swung a hammer on the dusty streets of Palestine. But at the center of the Christian message is a Lord. And not just a Lord of his people in a particular place at a particular time, but a Lord, the Lord of the universe, over all people, all times, all cultures. He lays claim over your life and my life. Massive claims at the center of the Christian message. Now, we're going to come to the nature of this authority in a moment by looking at the Bible. We won't look at the Bible as much as we normally do week to week tonight, because I do want to engage a little bit with some of the responses, the thinking that people have brought to this question. But we will get there, and I trust it'll give you a taste for the things of Jesus. So firstly, let's look at that first category of responses that people gave, which is we fix the world's problems by fixing up the authorities that we have. And the first way that people, a number of people said we fix it, is by more women or all women political leaders. Now, a couple of little giggles. I want to be careful not to giggle, I could get in trouble here. It's actually quite a popular notion, and maybe for good reason. Because there's some research, some legit research, that suggests that women politicians are less likely to be corrupt than men. Now, I'm interested in your gut reaction to that, and I want to see hands. Who reckons that's false? A couple of sheepish guys putting their hands up there. Women take note of these men. They're honest, they're brave, maybe a little bit foolish. Who reckons it's true? Yeah, okay, it's half and half. Well, Mexico City reckon there's something in it, because in 1999, they replaced all of their transit police officers with women, got rid of all the men to try and cut down on the rampant corruption. So are women inherently more honest and upright than men? Because if they are, then of course that would go a long way to fixing the problems in the world by putting women in leadership. Well, further research shows that the context determines the likelihood of corruption between the genders. So that amongst governing systems where corruption is stigmatized, it's looked down upon, it's frowned upon basically by voters, that's kind of like our government here, women generally avoid corruption because they are punished more severely by voters, this research has found. Because, you know, a man comes out and shows to be dishonest on his policies and with his personal life, and the response is, he's a man, what do you expect? A woman does it, and there's this vibe of, we expect better. Double standard? Of course, big time. But it might be that a woman avoids corruption, not necessarily because she's holier than a man, but because she faces a different level of incentive to avoid it. See, the researchers also found that, generally speaking, women will take risks less than men. And this actually rings true of my view of life. I just cancelled our roadside insurance on our car. and Brie, my wife, she's not very keen on that. She wants me to take it back up, probably because it's her car and not mine. But I reckon blokes are more willing to take a risk. And so if corruption is a risky thing and could end your career, then if this research is right, then that might also explain why women are less willing to take those risks. But, and this is really insightful, the research found that in governing, where corruption is part and parcel of the system, like in autocracies, or even some democracies like India, where corruption is just how you do things, it was found that women are just at home with corruption as men. Absolutely no gender difference. Now, that's no surprise when you get the diagnosis Jesus brings to the human condition. And this was all of last week. And if you weren't with us, let me encourage you to go chase that up, because it flavors everything that we look at from here, how we look at life. But let me give it to you really briefly. And I think I've actually got the text that we looked at last week, the headline statement. Jesus, massive claim, says, actually, you know what the problem is? It's not out there. It's not the world, it's not the structures, it's actually in here, in the hearts of men and women, comes evil thoughts, comes adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, and so forth. And so, Jesus is saying, it's not the world that then corrupts us, it's actually the corruption in us that has led to a broken world, to a corrupt world. Men and women alike sharing in this problem. And so, yes, in many cases, women have not been given the same opportunities as men. But here's my prediction. As women do begin to take up more of those opportunities that have historically been taken only by men, we will have an increasing disappointment and disillusionment as we find that women are just as fundamentally flawed as men, who have just had more opportunity to prove it, to show it, who have been in the spotlight. If you go by Jesus' take on who we are, women, all women, more women, might help some things, but actually if you have a complete culture change, the research is already suggesting, secular research, you wouldn't see any difference. So that was the first suggestion. All women, science, research, and even Jesus saying it's not going to work. Here's the second response that, again, a number of people made, that we would fix the world by legislating against political corruption. Now, I don't know how much you track with political government news. I find that young people are either one of two extremes. They just, whatever, don't care. Or I want to be a politician. I want to be the prime minister. It's kind of not much in the middle. But if you do track with it somewhat, you will have heard that over the last year, couple of years, the New South Wales governance, not just one party, has been exposed big time for corruption. And in fact, the Central Coast region has become synonymous with political corruption. Now, that then leads to political leaders saying things that voters want to hear and vote for. All right, we've got to get tougher on corruption. Let's put more laws and keep safes in place so that we can stamp out corruption. But seriously, we all know that where there is a will, there's a way. Yeah? And again, Jesus is saying that within all of us, there is a will to get ahead, to take a shortcut. Within all of us is malice and deceit. And so it's just that many of us don't have that opportunity in the spotlight, in the parliament, to show it off. And so we do want to be really careful to not go, all right, that bunch of people who are ruling right now, they're the problem. If we could just get rid of them and then get that bunch of people, we'd be sweet. Or myself, if I could jump in, I'd show them how it's done. Listen to this quote from a politician from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who says, in the Congo, in order to survive, we all have to be a bit corrupt, a bit ruthless. That's the system here. That's just the reality of things. If you don't bribe a bit and play to people's prejudices, someone else who does will replace you. Even you, if you were thrown into this system, you would do the same or sink. That person is agreeing with the diagnosis of Jesus, that no legislation or safeguard will actually deal with the problem of the human heart. Third response is that we should get some fairer laws that bring about a more just and equitable society. And so this is actually shifting the focus from the politicians themselves to their policies, which is actually not a bad idea to spend more attention on what they're actually planning to do. And so this thinking is, if we could just reduce that gap between the haves and the have-nots, then we'd fix the world. Now, I want to say that that is a beautiful, right, worthy ideal, worth chasing after. But, oh, so complex. So complex. I'm not even going to try and dip into it now. Again, let me refer back to Jesus' statement. He says that greed isn't something that we get sucked into, given the opportunity. It's actually something lurking in here that will just spew out. Now, this isn't to say that legislation doesn't matter and can't help. Of course it can. But if Jesus is right, then the heart of our world's problems lies in the hearts of legislators and, get this, voters. And so there is no way that law, new laws, better laws, tweak laws, will fix our problems. Think about the nature of law. It's generally trying to prevent the harm that we would do to each other rather than encourage and flourish the good that is in us to come out. Says something about us. You know that Jesus also said that we would always have the poor with us. Not because he wants that to be the case, but because he's realistic about human governance and about the amount of equality that we will achieve. Legislation really matters, but it's not going to fix the world. Fourth response, and I was interested that there were a number of people that said this one. Basically, I think behind it was this frustration and this bewilderment that we have so many different systems and thoughts and kind of ideologies and rulers. Come on, can't we just simplify things and fix things by just one system and one ruler? We'll all hold hands and get along. Now, before you scoff too quickly at that idea, I want to say that, well, Jesus says there's something in it, and we'll come to it in a moment. But really, exactly which system will 7 billion human beings willingly place themselves under? You know, because if we're not willingly placing ourselves under this authority, then it's force. This is where oppression kicks in. Do you honestly think that Australians would be happy with the Russian president over us? Do you honestly think the Chinese would be happy with Tony Abbott over them? It's just, I mean, Aussies are having a hard enough time with that. It's a beautiful picture. But I want to suggest it's in the camp of John Lennon, the Beatle, who in his song Imagine said, imagine there's no countries. Imagine there's no religions. Therefore, in his thinking, there would be nothing to kill and die for. We'd be one. We'd be at peace. Hasn't happened. Isn't likely to happen. Now, much more could be said about why authorities are crucial to our well-being as a society, but why they can't actually fix the deep hurts and problems within them. At best, what our political leaders, our policies, our legislations are doing are putting band-aids on a sore. You know, it's like, and often what they're doing is running to a sore that had a band-aid on it, it's fallen off, and so they're putting it back on again. It's this can never get ahead to fix the world. Now, that sounds pessimistic, I don't know, and particularly amongst young people who have been raised to think, no, no, you can change the world. You can do it. We can do it. Be positive. We can do it. But according to Jesus, it's not pessimistic, it's realistic. But it's also realistic according to history. See, don't you think throughout all of human history, the time that we've had, we would have figured out how to fix authorities and therefore fix the world by now? There was a guy who lived at just the end of the Roman rule, the Roman Empire as it collapsed. His name was Augustine. He was a philosopher and a theologian. He said, God allowed the Roman Empire to last 1,000 years because Roman rule was good for the promotion of social stability. But its usefulness gave way to corrupted self-interest and it was destroyed. Ah, we're onto something that's working for 1,000 years. Ah, it didn't last. And so that leads many people to say, see what the problem is? Power, authority, it always corrupts people and then in turn breaks our societies. You know what the problem, you know what the solution is? Get rid of authorities altogether. Which takes me to that second category of responses that I saw as I read through the responses. Now, this is a big issue. Big issue, because I want to suggest that actually takes us to an issue which is the deep yearning of all of us. Because it takes us to the issue of freedom. Freedom. We all want to be free. Freedom is where it is at. Free from oppression and tyranny. So does authority, which by definition requires obedience and submission, does authority deny freedom? Do the two things stand opposed so the only way to get this freedom we want is to throw off authority? Well, I reckon that many, if not most, authorities are distrusted or resented in some way. Whether it's parents over children, you know, especially the teen years, and policemen and politicians over citizens, or a creator God over his created people. Distrusted, mistrusted, resented, and therefore thrown off. Which I want to suggest leads to the popular understanding of freedom as being a negative one. I think the way that we as a community think about freedom is a negative one. I'll tell you what I mean. It's thought that freedom is to be the absence of authority and constraint and commitment and responsibility. If I could just throw those things off, then I'd be free. See how it's stated negatively? It's freedom from something. And you might think, well, duh, what else, what other kind of freedom is there? Well, we're going to come to it. A way better one, a way truer one. Firstly, let me just point out a couple of problems with this popular understanding of freedom. And I'll use the marriage illustration first. Ladies and men, but particularly ladies, as you look for a marriage partner, someone who you are willing to spend the rest of your days with and share common goals with, and hopefully one of those being the raising of a family, do you want a man whose idea of freedom is the absence of authority and constraint? Do you want a man who thinks actually getting away from the constraint of his wedding vows will be a good thing? Or are you going to be most happy and free if you find a man whose understanding of freedom is actually to be constrained by the promises that he's made to you? That you and you alone will be the woman on the planet that he gives himself to. For better, for worse, for rich, for poorer, sickness and health. Do you want a man who's actually going to be under the authority of the promises that he's made, bound by their constraints, taking on the responsibility of that commitment? Can you start to see the problem of just thinking of freedom as something that is the absence of those things? Let me give you another example which involves the purpose in your life. If I pursued my dream of freedom in my early 20s, I would not be here right now. I'd be up in Byron Bay, out the back of Byron Bay, up in the hills, enjoying the ocean and the music and the art and the culture and the slightly illegal parts of that region. That's where I'd be. That's my idea of, or was my idea of freedom and the good life. Now, I would do anything I could to get up there, and went there so many times in so many different ways. I got a car, I bussed, I got a bus, I got a train. I could never afford a plane. But imagine on one of my trips to, it's got to be one of the most beautiful destinations in the world. Imagine I'm on the train this one time. And silly example, but imagine if the train said, hey, I'm sick of these tracks. I'm sick of being bound by them and going on the same path, heading the same place. You know what? Those hills over there with the beautiful green grass, I'm headed over there. I'm going to act on my impulse and go that way. Silly example, but is a train most free when it just heads off into the boggy grass or when it's constrained to the environment for which it was made? When can the train go the fastest, travel the safest, and, here's the purpose part, arrive at a beautiful destination? When it is bound to the constraints for which it was made. Which has got to cause us to ask, well, what are the constraints that I'm made for? What are the boundaries? What is the environment for which my life was made? And here's the big one. What's the destination for my life? The right one. Because our notion of freedom determines whether our lives are headed somewhere beautiful or nowhere at all. Keep thinking about freedom with me for a little bit. Because it's thought that a free person is one who can be spontaneous. Yeah, it's like the virtue of youth. You know, so you've got a job or no job that allows you to just jump in a car and head on a road trip up the coast. You've got a relationship which you can just head out the door any moment to the pub with the boys when they call. It's freedom's thought of the spontaneity which enables you to hook up with a guy or a girl at a party in the moment, just free to do that. Now, on the surface, spontaneity seems like freedom, being able to do whatever I want, whenever I want. But when you look at it honestly, when you do a little bit of thinking, under the surface, you're not free. You're just obeying the commands of your compulsions, your desires and passions. That's the opposite to freedom. You're enslaved to yourself. So it's the alcoholic who takes another drink, enslaved to his compulsion. It's the predator who attacks sexually because he acts on his desires. True freedom isn't just responding to impulse, regardless of how enjoyable that resulting experience is. True freedom involves a conscious, considered choice. True freedom involves a conscious, considered choice. Often going against our impulses. Usually never spontaneous. But the problem with that definition is people go, that's not freedom, that's boring. That's marriage. I don't want to go there. That's a full-time job. I don't want that commitment. That's a mortgage and owning a home, not being able to skip around. I don't want that. That's the problem with how we view freedom. So if you think about it, true freedom isn't the absence of authorities, but rather the presence of good authorities. True freedom isn't the absence of authorities. You can never get away from some kind of authority. It's rather the presence of good authorities. Authority that liberates us to be the people we were intended to be. Like a train is liberated, stuck on the tracks. Like a fish is free to be what it's intended to be in the water of the pond, not on the land. And see, this is the other type of freedom I mentioned earlier. This is the kind of freedom that is stated positively, because it's not merely being free from something, but actually being free to something, to be something. And importantly, to be, in our case, the people we were intended to be. Massive difference in the way that we think about authority. And this is the kind of freedom that the Bible holds out. A positive freedom. And actually, it doesn't start with the issue of freedom. It starts with the issue of authority. But get this, an authority that actually frees. An authority that actually enables the freedom that we want. An authority that causes people to flourish and in turn, communities to be changed. The authority the Bible is on about and the resulting freedom is radical. And all of this authority, it's bound up in the person of Jesus. And so now I want to come and take you to those words that we had read a little bit earlier and just briefly consider what's in there. It is so rich, it is so gold, I can't do it justice, but let me show you a few things there. Now, as Dan mentioned, it's one of the accounts of Jesus that we're looking at. There's four accounts in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're independent. And this one is written by one of the eyewitnesses named John, one of the closest disciples to Jesus. And it's really key that I tell you this little bit because we're jumping into chapter 10 of his writing, which means we've missed the whole stack. And he opens up his book with something really important for us to hear to help us understand what comes after. And he opens up with his massive, couldn't overstate his massive claim that Jesus, this carpenter from Nazareth, was actually present before the creation of the world. That this Jesus is actually the one through whom and for whom everything was made. That this Jesus is actually God. God who 2,000 years ago for us entered into this world, who put on flesh as a man for a purpose, to come and rescue people who had thrown off the authority of God, thinking he's a party pooper, he's going to stifle my freedom, this is where life is at. And the diagnosis of Jesus is that's all of us, that's where we all find ourselves. But enter Jesus, not to come and condemn, but to come and rescue these people, to come and show us the positive freedom, to free us from the enslavement in which we find. So that's the opening part. It's massive claims, but helps us make sense of this chapter 10 where we jump in. And the identity of Jesus is again on view. And I want to suggest that pretty much all the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all these documents are concerned about is pointing you to the identity of Jesus. And so if you have not read this as an adult, please do it. I don't know how you could be a thinking person, a rational person, an open-minded person if you haven't at least considered the words of Jesus for yourself. Do it. They're radical. And so here we find that Jesus is speaking to his identity himself, and he's using a metaphor. He's using a figure of speech where he's using shepherds and sheep and sheep pen. Now, who got close enough to a sheep this week to touch it? Who even saw a sheep this week? You went to New Zealand. There's like not many sheep around us, right? We're pretty removed from this agricultural thing. But the gist of it, it's not that hard to track with. A shepherd, he leads. He has authority. A sheep is led, is a follower, submits. And so this is the metaphor Jesus is using to point to realities outside of this little metaphor about himself and about history, as we'll see. But Jesus describes himself a number of times as the good shepherd, as the good leader, the good authority, and contrasts himself with bad authority, bad leadership. And so if in this short amount of time I've at least intrigued you as to this authority that is good and required for our ultimate freedom, then I reckon you'd want to at least ask the question, well, what does this authority look like? What is it? What is this authority that if I give myself to, bring myself under, will bring about the freedom that I yearn for? Well, it looks like Jesus. It looks like Jesus. And I want to just point out five aspects of his perfect authority that we see in just these few verses here. I'm going to work through them pretty quickly. five aspects of perfect authority. Now, the first aspect is that this authority has rightful claim over those it leads. So you have a look there at verse 1. Anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. So he keeps contrasting things. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. Two verses later, verse 3. This shepherd calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. Authority that we rightly cringe at and usually suffer under is authority that grabs what isn't theirs. That's where the oppression kicks in. It's that kind of might is right, grab for power. Or not just might, but manipulation. I've been interested to read into the life of Hitler. And Hitler found himself the dictator that he was through might and manipulation, grabbing authority that wasn't his. But Jesus, his authority is good, it is perfect, because it is over that which is rightfully his. Which is why the opening part of this document is so important, because if it's true, then Jesus was the one who made all things and the one for whom all things exist, your life, my life. And so his claim for authority over us is right. It's his. There's the first aspect. It's making a claim rightfully over the people who are led. Secondly, good, perfect authority deals relationally, personally, intimately. This is beautiful. The sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. A beautiful picture of the God of the universe, the Lord of all the world, who speaks tenderly to those he leads, whose authority is expressed personally. He knows the name of every one of his sheep. Not in a I'm God and know everything kind of sense, in a personal, relational, intimate sense. He knows his follower. If you are one of those, take it, he knows you. He knows your name. He knows you intimately. Thirdly, good, perfect authority found in Jesus leads from the front and actually leads for a purpose. See, the purpose of knowing and speaking to his sheep in verse 3 is to lead them. He calls his own sheep, not just for a little conversation, not just for some comfort, by name, and leads them out. When he's brought all of his own, he goes on ahead of them and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. Then in verse 9, Jesus switches the metaphor and starts speaking of himself as the gate to the sheep pen. Verse 9, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Here's a key aspect of good, perfect authority. It is for the nurture of those who are being led. Good authority nurtures those it leads. The motivation of bad authority, of corrupt authority that Jesus comes down on so heavily, is to steal, kill, destroy. Jesus says his motive is to actually bring life, to actually bring his followers to pasture. And this authority has a purpose, has a destination. It's headed somewhere. Have a look at verse 16. I think it's the next slide. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. That's why I said earlier, not to scoff or laugh too quickly at people's dream to do away with all these systems and rulers and for there to be one. Jesus says that is the goal of history. That is where he is working all things, that there would be unity. What is naive and offensive to Jesus is to think that we can do that ourselves, that this is going to come about through earthly leadership. Jesus actually says elsewhere that his kingdom is not of this world. It's of a different order. So thirdly, good authority, it leads from the front with a purpose. Fourthly, good and perfect authority, it sacrifices. And here's the guts of what Jesus is about. This is key. Verse 11, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's the hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. Who wouldn't be willing to follow, to submit to an authority who was willing to take a bullet for you? Who was willing to give himself up for you? And so when you come to Jesus, when you come to the Bible's view of perfect authority, it is radical because it is authority that loves. It is authority where Jesus would die for you to protect you, to free you from the enslavement that you find yourself in, all kinds of enslavement, including our passions and our desires, ourself. Jesus, the Good Shepherd, offers freedom. But don't think that it came for free. It cost him his life. And in one sense, the cross of Jesus is this picture of great weakness. Yet when you get what is happening there, and we're going to push into this some more over the next few weeks, we actually see that this is the triumphing of his authority. That this man strung up on a cross is actually a throne from which he rules and reigns and brings about his purposes. So fourthly, so importantly, good authority that you can entrust yourself to sacrifices, gives himself up for you, for me. Fifthly and finally, good authority, perfect authority sent in Jesus, it conquers. It conquers. See, this is not just a cute children's story to be told before bed. Jesus is using a metaphor to teach about truths about himself and events in history. See, jump back into the metaphor for a second. Okay, you've got this good shepherd who's willing to sacrifice himself for his sheep. A pack of wolves are coming along. He sees them. He loves his sheep, so he throws himself in between them. The wolves attack and maul and kill him. The sheep, they get away. They survive. But their shepherd's dead. They survive for, what, a little while? The wolves are still alive. Their shepherd isn't. What's going to happen next? They're going down. So the authority that Jesus brings is not just an authority that sacrifices. It's an authority that conquers as well. Have a look at verse 17. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. Hear the purpose in this man. This is not some poor guy who fell victim to, you know, an injustice. He's headed to his death. But I also have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. Jesus is here referring to his resurrection. And not a metaphor for turning over a new leaf for a fresh start. He's referring to an event in history where a dead, decomposing body came back to life again. In the flesh, he ate and drank. He appeared to many people. And so Jesus, in his resurrection, conquers the very thing that has authority over every single person in this room. Death. 10 out of 10. You can't have beards and preach in this place, can you? It's like, man, what would Jesus do? He'd preach with a beard. Come on. Sorry. Let's try again. 10 out of 10 people in this room are going to die. It has authority over all of us. And yet Jesus, in his resurrection, he conquers it. He says it doesn't have to be the case. It doesn't have to be the end. He comes back to life so that this good shepherd is now alive and well and able to still call his sheep, able to still nurture and provide for his sheep, able to still protect them, and get this, able to still lead them to a purpose, to a point. And it's a beautiful picture. It is a place of one flock with one shepherd, people from all racial backgrounds, people from all forms of governance, people from all kinds of religions finding themselves together, unified, as we all desire. So there's five quick points as to the nature of this good authority. But just before we pause for questions, I've got a couple of things to say, but just we'll pause for questions in a minute. When we hear that God is king of all, we can import our distrust, our resentment, our bad experiences with other authorities. We can import that onto God and say, no, can't be good, can't be trusted. I'm going to be best off, I'm going to be most free if I get out and stay out from under that authority. But when you look who God is in Jesus, and that's what Jesus is saying, you want to know what God is like? Look at me, says Jesus. You see that he's good, that he's good, that he is gentle without being weak, that he is strong without being brutish, that he's entitled without being coercive. He is the good shepherd, the good authority, the one under whom you find life. You find that thing that you're yearning for, to be in relationship with God.
Right.
That's good. Keep thinking about these things. Keep asking people who have brought you, or keep coming to life, whatever. Keep checking these things out. They're massive. If nothing else, I hope you've heard that the things of Jesus are not just a nice fluffy way to kind of stir in your life and make it a little bit better. These are huge. I'll finish by saying this. The issue isn't whether you will be under authority or not, but rather which authority will it be, and will this authority be for your good? It might claim to me, it might promise to be, but has it justified it? Can it back those claims up? Can it deliver it? The authority of Jesus doesn't change whether you accept him or reject him. The authority of Jesus, it doesn't change regardless of your response to him. Because if his claims are true, he is the Lord of the universe. See, what does a leader need by definition to be a leader? Followers. A leader who heads out without followers is just out for a walk. Jesus is radically different. Because before the world was created, he is Lord. And so get this, he doesn't need you. He doesn't need me. We don't complete him. Which is exactly why he can act for our good to free us. It's exactly why our Lord could actually wash the feet of his servants and still be Lord. It's exactly why this Lord could be strung up on a tree and crucified and still be Lord. Your response to Jesus doesn't change who he is in his authority. So let me leave you with some of his words. Your Lord, my Lord Jesus. Elsewhere he says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. The authority of Jesus does not change whether you reject him or accept him as your Lord. But he promises that you will change if you come back into relationship with the God for whom you were made. If you accept this invitation of the Good Shepherd, come to him. I encourage you to do that tonight. Come back to your Lord. At the very least, keep taking steps to look into the claims of this man who says he's your Lord.